Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, it's my pleasure to be speaking to Louise Erdrich, the author of The Painted Drum. This is her most recent book. It's published by HarperCollins. Recently, she also published Four Souls, and she, of course, began with Love Medicine, continued with The Beat Queen and Tracks, and all of these novels have been part of an ongoing saga of the Ojibwe people from whom she descends. It's kind of an amazing saga, and The Painted Drum is a particularly good place to begin because it's a novel. It's her first novel, I think, that's set in current times. It cuts across three generations. For people who've been reading her all along, those who want to know about the origins of the formidable Fleur Pillager will find them out here and find out why she is so indomitable. And I wanted to begin by asking, Louise, you say that this book came over a very long period of time, I believe around 9 years. Why was it different from the others?
Well, first of all, hello. I'm so glad to be talking to you and to your listeners. Hi. The book did start a long time ago, and part of it is set in New Hampshire, which is the first time I've ever set anything in the East. And I wrote that part of it, I think it was in 1989. And so I started it way back when and added to it incrementally, just over through the 90s. I would put a piece here and a piece there, and slowly it began to fit together. And then in the last couple of years, I really pulled it together.
It's kind of astonishing because essentially it tells three stories, each one of which has as a kind of crisis point the sacrifice of a young girl for her sibling or siblings. In fact, what we see is in the first such sacrifice, a girl is thrown to the wolves, which is a story which occurs, as you say in your author's note, in mythology. It crops up in Willa Cather's novel, My Antonia. It's kind of a shocking event, and it's as if the creation of the drum is such that although a second girl will sacrifice herself for her sister, the third girl, once the drum has been brought back, has been calmed and honored and fed with tobacco smoke, the third girl will not die, although she will attempt her sacrifice. How did that sacrifice, self-sacrifice of a child, come to you?
I'm so glad that you're seeing it this way. I wanted it to be a book about the heroism of young girls. And of course, I have daughters, but I see this in girls all the time, this kind of enormous love of a sibling and a selfless kind of love. And I wanted some way to talk about it. I didn't know that was what the book was about. Of course, for many years, it just slowly came together. But the drum, or the ceremony of the drum itself, ends in saving, in the girl successfully saving herself as well as her siblings. And I think that is what I was striving for in the book, some way to rescue the children who work so hard, not only to save their siblings, but in many cases to save their parents.
Now, these books deal a lot with what I would call, comparative mythology. They are about taking stories that recur through generations and finding, in a sense, an Ur myth. And in a way, the painted drum by my guest, Louise Erdrich, is that in its purest form. We watch this tale told several times over. We're in a world in which all sorts of congruencies and recurrences are to be found. It's almost a sense, what would the word be? I would call it destiny.
There is a kind of fatalism at the core of these, of the character's view of life. This particular girl, who I think forms the center, the core of the book. Was she thrown? Was she sacrificing herself? That remains in the air. But the fact is, she comes back, and she insists on being a guiding spirit. It's not as though people have any choice. She's there. She's at her mother's side. She's always there to help. I think that all this time I've been, you mentioned Fleur, I've been working on this particular character who won't leave me alone. And in fact, it isn't just that I want to create her. She won't leave me alone. When I was in one of those sleepless states and really despairing, I think I had to do something very important the next day. I would never get to sleep. I fell into some sort of dream state, and Fleur was there to say, I'm coming back into the next book. I am here. And this is where she wanted to be. And she decided, I think, that this was her origin. I really didn't know. The connections make themselves. It's not as though I really know when they're going to happen. I'm writing for a long time, and all of a sudden I realize what I'm writing toward. It's toward the origin of this particular character, Fleur.
Yes, she's been called by some of the critics one of the towering presences in contemporary American literature, and so it's particularly interesting to find her origin as someone who has her life as the result of a sacrifice by a sibling, and then mm-hmm. to watch essentially two mothers working to subdue the betrayer who has spoiled all the lives around him. And so she goes out as from a den of depraved origin to operate within the world. She is a vengeful spirit.
Exactly. She's a very complex spirit, because she's a twinned spirit, because her sister, who has sacrificed herself and is looking after her still from her own spirit presence, is always going to be with her. So in many cases farther on in her character, you almost get the sense that she's got another person who's standing beside her. She's stronger and more prone to a tearing kind of action than many people, and in prone to a careless kind of solidity in her life. And it's because she has this other person who's always there with her. It's that sibling who sacrificed herself.
Now, I'm very interested. You gather stories, and in your author's note, you thank someone for trusting you with a particular story. Can you tell about that, and what is that process like of gathering?
I don't really know when it's happening. You know, I sometimes look back and I've taken in some kind of story, but I did have this person say, write this down. And so I did write down the germ of something, which as I say in the book later, was also something I then realized was a very deep mythological It's like you said, an tale, a text, something that's really deep in the human psyche and recurs in different cultures. this was another version of the story. I think there's ongoing stories that we tap into certain pieces of them, and especially as a writer, you become sensitized to the germ of a story. In the beginning, there's a germ of a story that involves a car flying off a bridge out over a river, and it's a sort of symbol of mistaken flight. You know, it's like the Icarus story, and all of these stories have their counterparts in some mythology. It's true.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Louise Erdrich, author most recently of The Painted Drum, published by HarperCollins. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Louise Erdrich about her new novel, The Painted Drum. I thought I'd ask you to read the opening of the chapter, The Wolves, in a certain way, because it's self-sustaining, but also because there's a vision in it which is very much at the heart of the vision of these novels. This is Louise Erdrich. This is the beginning of Chapter 3 of the second part of the book, The Wolves.
My father is a Shawano, and I've grown up in the range of those wolves, though I didn't understand for a long while, of course, how it was that they related to our family. In summer, that pack disappears on the far mainland where the shore is still wild and never was developed. I hardly ever hear them then. But in winter, they come out onto the ice of the lake and hunt the islands. Then their howls travel through the frozen space, and to hear them brings back all the tumult of my heart in younger days. I don't know why their cries do that to me. Perhaps it is because I've always had that longing, that need, to pierce through my existence. I'm a boundary to something else, but I don't know what. Mostly I have made my peace with never knowing. But when I hear the wolves, that falls away. Unrest grips me. I have to leave my house and go out walking in the night, hungry to know what I cannot know, and desperate to see what will always be hidden. There was an old man once who wanted to be with the wolves and know their thoughts. He went out on the ice and sang to them and asked them to sink their teeth into his heart. I guess the singing kept him warm enough, so he lived out there for 3 days and nights. On the fourth day, the wolves finally came to him, or rather he realized that all along he had been looking straight at them, and only when they were ready had they let themselves be seen. I know about this man because I sat with him in the hospital just a few years ago, and I talked to him while I was on night duty. I pulled a chair up next to his bed. "Those wolves were curious," he said, "just like anyone would be. What in the heck's this young man, I was young then, sitting out here on the ice for? They came up to find out if I was dangerous or crazy or good to eat. Even then I was tough and stringy, so I guess they decided. Crazy. They sat and watched me for several hours to see if I would do anything, and after a while they went away. I asked the old man if he'd learned what he needed to learn from them, if he'd found anything out at all. "Oh, sure," he said. "I've found out they think like us. They were watching me, but I was watching them, too. I was hungrier than they were. They had just eaten. They were full." One yawned. Another started playing hockey with a piece of ice. I couldn't believe that. "It's true," he insisted. "They play with things. They like to play with those big blackbirds, those ravens. Sometimes the ravens get the wolves to hunt for them. I've seen it where the ravens come back and tell the wolves where there is something to kill and eat. I thought, if the raven and the wolf can get along, perhaps the man and the wolf can get along too. But I couldn't stay out there long enough to test that out. Well, their thoughts. Did you know their thoughts? I asked. Did you find out what you were looking for? The old man knew I was trying to pin him down, and I could tell. He wasn't sure if he wanted to tell me something. He was silent, turning things over in his mind. But at last he must have decided to take a chance and tell me. There was one wolf in particular, a gray wolf, he said, who came back several times and sat before him. Suddenly, that wolf was staring at him with a human's eyes in the face of a wolf. The old man did not know when it was he looked at the wolf and found he was staring back at it. But at some point he was aware that he and this particular wolf were holding each other's gazes and had been doing so for some time. The wolf was asking him a question, he realized, and he knew after some more staring what that question was. The old man stopped. Well, what was it? I was impatient to know. Oh, his thoughts came back to me. A standard question, he was asking me. Do you want to die? But that is just wolf practice, asking that. I wanted to get past that and into something else. So I formed a question of my own in my mind, and without ceasing my direct stare, I spoke to the wolf, asking my own question. Wolf, I said, your people are hunted from the air and poisoned from the earth and killed on sight, and you are outbred and stuffed in cages and almost wiped out. How is it that you go on living with such sorrow? How do you go on without turning around and destroying yourselves, as so many of us in Anishinaabeg have done under similar circumstances? And the wolf answered, not in words, but with a continuation of that stare. We live because we live. He did not ask questions. He did not give reasons. And I understood him then. The wolves accept the life they are given. They do not look around them and wish for a different life or shorten their lives resenting the humans or even fear them any more than is appropriate. They are efficient. They deal with what they encounter and then go on, minute by minute, one day to the next. And so, my friend, I did learn what I had come there to find out. I'll tell you now. I wanted to know how not to kill myself. For that very thing was my intention. It had been so for weeks. I could see no way around it. I knew what chaos and everlasting questions such a death brings down upon the living. But I was past caring about that. Since I was resigned to killing myself, you could say my life was nothing. My life was cheap. So, before I went through with it, I decided I would sit with the wolves. Oh, you never killed yourself, obviously, I said, but did you perhaps try? The old man didn't answer directly. He sat up. Open the tie on this bare-ass dress, he said, and look. When I opened his shirt, I saw across his back and shoulders the regular, deep, violet-brown scars of a sun dancer who pulled buffalo skulls. That's what I did instead.
Louise Erdrich, reading from her newest novel, The Painted Drum. Now, this answer seems to be the answer throughout the novel, that there is a chaos that disrupts one's desire for every day, and that the chaos leads to chaotic behavior, whether it's alcoholism, abandonment of wives, spouses, children, and a terrible devastation that runs through the book seeking solution. And the solution here seems to be to live at the heart of chaos, believing in the necessity of the moment facing oneself. Is that your answer?
It's as much an answer as I can find. I think I'm always looking for the answer to these questions, and that I page through the books I'm writing and reading, trying to get a better grip on the answer to that question. But in this old man's answer, there's a kind of acceptance of pain, and a decision that makes the answer almost, I wouldn't say useless, but meaningless. It's the answer that the wolves give, which is, we live because we live. And that's enough for now, you know.
In that author's note I've referred to, you say, as in all my books, no sacred knowledge is revealed. I check carefully to make certain everything I use is written down already. And certainly, one of the feelings one gets as certain characters look at the beadwork of others and say, this is careful work, this is careful and respectful work. You know, when you're reading Louise Erdrich, how much care and love has gone into the narrative. But I'm curious if you would tell me about the way in which one learns but avoids using sacred knowledge.
Oh, that's a very pertinent question. This happens all the time. And I think particularly with writers, native writers, because there's a certain sense that the cultural depth has to somehow be protected, or, you know, there's certain things you don't want to write about. And I make decisions all of the time, and I try as best I can to make certain that there's nothing out there that isn't in a book already. So a lot of the things might be things that I knew from life in some way, from being around, but I don't want to, I do want to stay true to my relationships with elders and other people. I don't want to use those to reveal something. And that's why I cite the book that I do, Thomas Benham's book, which is a wonderful book. And in fact, a lot of people who do work with drums read the book and find it very, very helpful.
Now, in order to make the drum that's central to this book, it's like a sacred quest. The artificer has to find the place where the ancestral wood has been stored. He has to do homage to that wood. When he gets there, he has to have dreams that tell him how to shape and decorate it. And finally, he's told a manner in which the drum can become his dead daughter, that she wants to be this drum. But it did strike me as being something of a parable of writing and art making. Are your own works the results of a quest for how finding the material, finding how to shape the material,
you know? Yeah. I think anything that's a lifelong human endeavor, something that takes up your mind and heart and whatever else we're made out of in a complete way, is a life quest, and it's something that I don't think I ever stop thinking about or working on? I'm always, if I'm not directly thinking about what's going into a book, I'm open, you know, I'm there for it.
Do you feel Do you feel it's a ceremonial role of a sort?
I never thought of it that way. It may be self-aggrandizing to think of it that way. You know, I don't know. I don't see myself that. But there is something that I suppose a ceremony is, I think, the daily enactment of a sense of the spirit. I mean, that's why we have ceremonies. We try to tend to the mystery somehow, and the ceremony, which often, you know, it can become an empty gesture, sure, but I think it could be said that going in and picking up your story where you left off and trying your best to put the words together is it's about as close as I can get to having some sort of relationship with the big mystery, you know, the real big one.
Oh, thank you, Louise. I've been talking with Louise Erdrich, author most recently of The Painted Drum, published by HarperCollins. It's a book that moved me a lot, and I found myself loving it so much that I read it twice in a row to see how it all rounds out. Thank you, Louise, for joining me.
Well, thank you, and thank you for... Absolutely. I would want it to round out. It's a drum. Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. Special thanks to recording engineer Sam Keenan at Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Down along a trail that never ends. To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books. Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.